The Five Leadership Questions podcast is brought to you by Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Southeastern desires to equip pastors, missionaries, theologians, scholars, and other believers to obey the commands of Jesus to make disciples anywhere and everywhere God calls them to go. They have a wide range of degrees at many levels. Whether you want to become a pastor, missionary, or seminary professor, Southeastern can provide you with the high-quality education and training that you need. Southeastern even provides a number of distance education options for those who are interested but cannot relocate. To learn more, visit sebts.edu/5LQ. That's sebts.edu/5LQ. Now, enjoy the podcast. Hey, and welcome to the Five Leadership Questions podcast. I'm your host, Barnabas Piper, here with Todd Adkins.
What?
Oh, Todd, I feel like we've done some recordings recently, but we haven't had a chance to hear that from you, so it's really good.
Yeah, that's encouraging. It's good to finally hear that again.
I feel like that really helps us hit our stride.
Hey, I have people hit me up on Twitter.
I know, it's becoming a thing.
When they, I didn't plan on it being a thing. It just kind of happened.
It's like hashtag 5LQ, hashtag what?
It concerns me about the audience.
We may not be reaching quite the level of leader we thought.
Like, oh, man, I hope Todd does that thing again.
That third voice you hear is one you're very familiar with. That's Eric Geiger. He is the vice president of the resources division here at Lifeway. So Todd and I both work under Eric. And about a week ago from when we're recording this, Eric gave a presentation to managers and a number of us in the resources division here about giving presentations. So it was a presentation on presentations. Very meta.
Yeah, it's kind of like I remember one time sitting in a lecture about why not to lecture.
That's right.
So I was really nervous.
Well, it's like Mortimer Adler's book, How to Read a Book, and it's like 480 pages long.
That is amazing.
It's 480 pages long.
It's still amazing.
So hopefully people throughout our division aren't saying, oh, I sat through the most boring presentation on how to not give boring presentations.
Well, to be fair, half of it was Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So whatever you did wrong, he made right.
Man, that isn't an amazing speech.
Yeah. No,
it's unbelievable.
What fascinated me was when you asked how many of you have never seen this in full. And like, what, a third of the room maybe?
I would say, and I think there were more who just didn't want to admit. I mean, because you're not sure if you did, and then after you listen to the whole thing. Honestly, I don't know if I had sat down with a lens like we did as a team and really – I'd heard tons and tons of times chunks of the speech.
Yeah.
I can't remember doing what we did, though, sitting down.
Well, I think it's – most people haven't heard the first 11 minutes. They've only heard from I Have a Dream.
Yep, and they were in the sticky lines after that point, you know, Let Freedom Roll.
I probably 2 or 3 years ago was the first time I had seen it in full, and I watch it probably 2 or 3 times a year since, just because I've never run across another. I mean, it's 18 minutes long, which is the length of your average TED Talk, and there isn't a TED Talk out there that is even in the same league in terms of quality of presentation.
It's truly, if you like look at people who evaluate presentations and speeches, it's like the undisputed best speech in American history.
And the reason we're talking about this is because our topic for the day is giving really good presentations. So what are the things that go into giving a top-notch presentation? So this could be a sales presentation. It could be a teaching context. It could be preaching. Presentation can be a lot of different things. But essentially, standing in front of a group of people or even one-on-one, what are the elements that make a fantastic presentation when I have a block of time to share information? So our first question is, what are the main components of a successful or quality presentation? And Eric, you had three that you talked us through, so I'm just trying to tee those up.
Okay, the three that I shared that I believe no matter when you're speaking or to whom you're speaking, the three would be logos, ethos, and pathos, which that comes from Aristotle. He said there's three qualities to every great...
Sounds like the Three Musketeers.
Hopefully, three qualities to every great Shatter presentation. And when you guys finish the side talking, let me know and I'll continue.
Sorry.
I'll continue.
We're ruining your presentation.
Gosh.
Well, first characteristic of a good presentation, no interruptions.
Yes. If you're heckled, what do you do?
Yeah.
You tell them to be quiet.
I guess you keep going. So three, and Aristotle would say this isn't only about the presentation. It's hard to separate the presentation from the presenter. And so you really have to evaluate if you have these three qualities as you're giving the presentation. So ethos is credibility. Logos is logic, clarity. Pathos is passion. So the three qualities of a successful presentation is going to be, they're going to be when a presenter has credibility or likability with the audience. So many times you will have an incredible, truthful presentation, even delivered with passion, but if the people in the audience don't respect or want to follow or want to listen to the presenter, it doesn't matter how clear the talk is or right. even how passionate the presenter delivers the talk. If there's not credibility, the people are not going to hear. So ethos is credibility, but you can't just have credibility. You then have to have logos or logic. And so there, you have to actually have some substance to what you're saying, some meaning behind all of the rhetoric,
yeah.
some truth behind all of the words.
So it can't just be, you know, a string of one-liners right. Or just, I mean, we've heard, you've heard passionate speakers who just sort of ramble through stories and you get to the end and you're like, that was really exciting. I don't really know what they said.
It was all pathos.
Yeah, all pathos. And then there's times, and it does show the how both ethos and pathos or pathos, how powerful they are mm-hmm. because you still walk away from that presentation saying, you may walk away laughing, crying, and really liking the presenter. But then when someone says, hey, what are the takeaways? What are the nuggets of wisdom? What are the action steps from? That's when you realize, wow, that presentation really was devoid of logic and of clarity.
Yeah.
But then the last one would be pathos, which would be passion. You have to have a deep-seated conviction in what you're presenting, a belief in what you're speaking about. So those three come together. Aristotle would say that's when you have a very, very effective presentation.
So the next four questions we have are trying to sort of take those three categories and flesh them out a little bit, because there's so many different styles of communicators. There's so many different types of presentations. So just trying to help people get some context on this. So let's take credibility as in our next question, and that is how can a presenter establish credibility with an audience, especially if it's an unfamiliar group? So that's the ethos.
Yes.
So I would say the first things first, even blending back into question one, it's the idea of knowing the audience and knowing that you have customized that presentation just for them. Because if you haven't, the credibility factor is going to bleed really badly.
Can you earn credibility if it's an unfamiliar audience?
Yeah, the unfamiliar is what makes it really challenging. So think about a pastor who does his life in front of a group of people. The way that pastor grabs credibility, or hopefully the division I lead here at Lifeway, the way I grab credibility is that people watch my life over a long period of time and they view me as someone who's trustworthy. He's going to tell me the mm-hmm. truth. He's honest.
Your actions and your statements line up.
Right.
That concept.
But going to an unfamiliar group, that's challenging. And so mm-hmm. to establish credibility, to Todd's point, I think the audience real quickly has got a sense that you love them, mm-hmm. that you've done some homework on them, that you care for them. The audience or the person you're sitting across, if you're in sales, that you're sitting across from has got a sense that you actually care for them and care for whatever it is that you're speaking to the person about, that you really want what's best for them, that's not inauthentic, that you're not just doing a job and trying to grab a paycheck. So there's got to be a real sense of love, I think, for the people that you're speaking to.
Yeah.
A practical way that I think you establish that is by both doing the homework on the person or the people that you're speaking to. Research can help you establish that. Mm-hmm. So if you're speaking to a large group of people, research, referencing your experience in that space.
Yeah.
So if you're speaking about student ministry and you're speaking to an audience of student ministry leaders, you ought to reference the shared experience you have with the audience.
Right.
So
you can reference.
You taught eighth grade Sunday school 10 years ago.
And you can reference reference that. The other thing I would say too is if you can borrow relational capital. So never underestimate if you're coming in to speak with somebody else's group, another leader's group, be sure that they set you up well, because you can borrow some of their relational capital.
Here's where it backfires, though. I've seen people, and I want to give a caution here, because you're like, man, I'm speaking to a group, or I'm presenting a group. I need to get some credibility. If you look like you're trying to get credibility, is the quickest way to lose all credibility. And where I see speakers do it is the over name dropping.
Yes,
that's just like, oh man, that
you look like a poser.
You're trying too hard.
This is a there's a I don't know if trend might be too strong of a word. I see it often from pastors where they do it on social media, they do it in blog posts, they do it in sermons, yeah. where they will reference people and say, my friend so-and-so, instead right. of just using referencing the content of a person. Yeah. So, you know, I could say, hey, Eric Geiger wrote this, or I could say, my friend Eric Geiger wrote this.
Well, I hope you call me a friend.
It has to be done within reason.
Right, I'm joking with you. Yeah, you're right. If it looks like you're only saying that to grab cred of a speaker,
right?
Yeah,
it's claiming relational capital for almost to manipulate people.
Yeah,
I think another way that a speaker can do this, especially if you're walking in cold, is treating. I mean, this fits with what you said, Eric, in terms of loving the audience. I think. The respect factor. So you don't speak to them as if they know nothing about what you're saying. You speak to them as if they're an intellectual equal. So if you're coming in as a guest preacher, speak as if people are smart enough to understand what you're saying. Speak to them as if they, you know, you don't need to talk down to your audience.
That's good.
I mean, if you're doing a sales presentation,
right.
Assume that they have some knowledge of the marketplace.
Yeah.
So when you make points of reference, you know, you compare one product to another, you assume that they probably know something about those other products.
That's good. That's really helpful, because if you talk down to an audience, that audience is going to sense that you don't respect them.
Right.
Therefore, they're going to have a hard time respecting you.
If it's a more of a one-on-one presentation or a smaller group, I think one of the best ways to establish credibility is actually to ask good questions.
Yes.
Because if I ask you an insightful question, you automatically infer on me, you know, intelligence or knowledge, because—
When interest shows respect. So asking good questions shows an investment in who that person is.
That's good. Yeah, you're doing the right thing because it's right.
Right.
But you simultaneously love the people. And so when you're doing the right thing because it's right— and you love the people that you're speaking to, you will win credibility with some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you lose credibility with all if you sacrifice who you are
right.
and violate who you are yeah. in an attempt to gain credibility.
Especially over the long run.
You totally lose credibility.
All right. So that was digging in a little bit to the idea of ethos and credibility. Let's move to the idea of pathos and passion. And the next question is, different presenters have different styles and there are myriad types of presentations. So what are various ways that passion can be communicated and exhibited clearly? So kind of what does passion look like? Because it doesn't look the same for everybody.
No, it doesn't. I think it was Martin Lloyd Jones that said preaching is conviction on fire or reason on logic on fire.
Yeah.
So that's what he said. Lloyd Jones said preaching is logic on fire, which is essentially two of the three things that
right.
Aristotle said.
If it's just logic, it's a lecture, and if it's just on fire, then it's noise.
Right. And so he hit both logos and pathos in that one statement. But yet, when you listen to Lloyd Jones, he is a phenomenal communicator. I love reading him, but he's not what you, when you think about on fire,
right.
you're thinking about this like screaming, very demonstrative. That's not how Lloyd Jones communicates. And so on fire doesn't necessarily mean what you're thinking of when you think of like this extremely expressive, exuberant, bombastic, you know,
right.
expressions.
It's not the same as emotive.
Yeah. Now, somebody can be that
right.
because that's who they are. But if your personality is more introverted, if your personality is more deliberate in your communication, pathos or passion doesn't mean that you're going to transform into somebody you're not on the platform. In fact, if you do that, you'll actually lose credibility.
You will. Mm-hmm.
So it's in line with who you are, with your personality, with who God really made you to be. To me, a better word for pathos would be conviction.
Yeah.
Can I sense in the person speaking that they are convinced?
Do they believe this?
They really believe this.
Well, because emotive does not equal evocative. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, evocative invokes you to action. And it's not necessarily, you know, you can have a passionate plea, but if you've got too much passion and there's not enough to back it up, then you just look like a mess up there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, and we've all seen presentations like that where somebody's, you know, somebody is crying or yelling or whatever, and you just kind of like, this is a lot of noise, and it's
right.
kind of awkward.
At the same time, there's people who do that really well because that's who they are.
Right.
Off
you think like you think stage. Like David Platt. I mean, David Platt cries regularly when he preaches. I mean, he gets very emotional, but it's clearly from a place of this is something that is welling up from inside of him because this is the thing that shapes him, informs him. He believes this message about
the nations,
saving the lost.
Yes. And so you believe and you've seen that this guy's going to do that in a one-on-one meeting sitting over dinner.
Yep.
So it's not as if this he's doing something different on stage that he does when he's talking one-on-one with somebody.
And I think – so it seems to me that what we're coming back to is that this is less about technique and more about content.
Conviction.
Yeah,
conviction around the content. I would say that Logos is the content and Pathos is the conviction around that content.
Right. So if you're in a sales job, for example, and you need to pitch a product, and you simply think the product is junk,
and you would never use it, and you don't believe in it, you really should.
You can
provide for your family and do that until you can find something that you believe in.
You can lean heavily on being a credible person and a logical presentation. But you're bordering on dishonest if you're trying to push a thing that you think is junk. And so that's where the conviction piece comes in. And usually people can tell. You know, if you go into a computer store and you can just tell that somebody's trying to make commission instead of actually tell you the truth about which computer is better or which one's better for your budget or whatever. They're just trying to upsell you. That comes through because that's not conviction. That's an ulterior motive. All right, next question. So this is dealing with the logos side, the logic side, because in Eric's presentation, you talked about the importance of preparation and how, you know, if you want to make a convincing argument for something, you have to be prepared. It's very hard to wing that. So what are some tips for effective preparation?
Hey, well, I'll tell you right now, my boss always says, if you don't
your friend Eric
in preparation, you'll bleed in battle.
That's true. He did say that very thing. My friend Eric said that.
Your friend. He's my friend.
Preparation is essential, and to me, that's a great quote. If you don't, I mean, if you Google it, you'll find it's been attributed to a bunch of people.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites. So we can just start throwing names on it.
Yeah.
Just the guy Abraham Lincoln
once said.
Winston Churchill.
I think Churchill is credited with saying so, but it is a great pithy statement. If you don't sweat in preparation, you'll bleed in battle.
Might have been Harry Truman. Who knows?
Another way you could articulate it would be you're going to have urgency when you speak. Okay, there's going to be a sense of like dread for at some point. Oh my goodness, I'm about to get up in front of a group of people, or I'm going to deliver this presentation to a small group or even an individual. So you're going to have a moment of urgency. You have a choice. Are you going to have chaotic urgency where you're running around in the final moments trying to throw something together? Or are you going to have focused urgency early? And so I believe great presenters choose to live with focused urgency so they don't suffer chaotic urgency
later on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean you're still not going to get nervous. I get nervous every time I speak, every single time. But I can look back and know I'm stepping up with confidence, not hopefully by God's grace, not cockiness, but confidence, because I know that I've done the work. I've worked hard preparing for that moment. To me, a tangible way, a gut check way on if you've prepared, whether it's a sermon or it's a talk you're giving, a leadership talk, is can I converse on this subject with somebody over lunch? Is it so in me that now when I speak from the stage, it will be monologue in nature more than dialogue in nature. But do I know this so well that I can sit down and have questions given to me about the content that I can actually enjoy having a conversation about this content because it's so in me.
Would you be afraid of a Q&A afterwards?
Right. It's good.
Yeah.
It's a good way to put it.
And this is part of the reason that I wanted to hone in on this is because, and I think Todd probably has a similar propensity, both of us are very confident, generally speaking, flying by the seat of our pants. So giving us a general topic, taking a little bit of time.
Yeah, y'all are more comfortable doing that than I am. Because, you know, all the times that you've had me on this on the podcast, I don't know if everyone you have on is like that. But as you know, my assistant will ask you ahead of time for the questions. And I like to jot down some general thoughts before I I come on. And
which is why I have to do almost no edits on the podcast we do with you.
Which, so I don't know if that's a positive thing or a negative thing for me. It's just for some reason the preparation deal is a value for me.
Well, that's something that when we did our 100th episode on this, one of the questions that we asked each other was, what's something you would like to do differently going forward, or you would do differently? And one of the things that I said was, I would like to do my homework a little bit better on these, on especially on guests. So coming in with a better sense of who are we talking to and things like that. So I mean, this is not a presentation in the formal sense. This is conversational, and I leaned heavily on that, but that often meant that if the guest didn't have a great answer or I wasn't real familiar with them, maybe the content wasn't as strong as it could have been. If I had done my homework better, if I had prepared better, I could have filled in some gaps. And so in a formal presentation, I often lean on my own ability to be like, I'm generally familiar with that. I can just riff on this. The flip side of that is that if you're very familiar with something, preparation looks different. So for example, Eric just released a book with Kevin Peck called Designed to Lead. You have lived in that content neck deep for years. Yeah. But the book itself for a year or two. And so that means if somebody invited you to be like, hey, can you come give a presentation on some of the themes of that book in 2 days?
Totally.
You don't have to panic. You can. No. You are in the content.
You can pull from the reservoir.
Yeah. But that is preparation.
Yeah. So I would say that I think I heard Johnny Hunt one time say, which I love this. People asked him how long he was preparing for a sermon. He said 30 years.
Yeah.
So for when you've been in a certain field or a certain discipline for a long time, you are pulling from a reservoir of deep investment. And so he's invested years in that preparation, in that talk. I think there's a threshold. And so here's, if I was drawing on a board, I'd say this. To me, the worst place to be is the moderate preparation place. Here's what I mean. So no preparation, like you guys for a podcast, you know, you're kind of bashing yourself for no preparation. But here's what you have and the audience has is it's like straight up authentic conversation. It's like someone sitting down with you two at a coffee shop and just asking questions. That's really what this podcast has become.
It is.
But then the worst is the mid-level preparation. Mm-hmm. So here's what mid-level preparation, you get deeply tied to your notes and you can't deviate at all.
Right.
When you get to then what I would call healthy level of preparation, you know the content so well, even if you have notes, you can shift from it without losing the rhythm, without losing the sense of you know what you're talking about, because you know it so well. You can X this out. You can chase this for a moment. It's the sales guy who sits down and is prepared, but only on the script.
Yeah.
And so when a question gets asked, the person can't answer because
it's like an automated phone service.
He or she only knows the script.
Yeah.
So to me to get to the really healthy spot, it's extreme prep because then you can, or healthy prep because then you can freestyle with that, yet still freestyle from within your wheelhouse of knowing the content.
Well, and two, I think there's something to be said for sometimes you can also be kind of a victim of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Was that on the podcast? Who said that?
Curse of knowledge is something that we talk about regularly. That's something that I heard at first in one of Chip and Dan Heath's books.
It was Will Mancini basically broke it down for me one time. We were having a conversation and he was like, you're a victim of knowledge. You, in a particular area of leadership, you have so much information, you don't always know which information to pull. And so for me, one of the things that Eric coached me through when I first got here was I would script out everything, but I wasn't as comfortable speaking because, you know, it's been 15 years since I prepared a message every week. Mm-hmm. But it was, hey, tie together these five tweets, basically, these five thoughts. And be sure that you have it timed between those, and you'll give
so
a much better
sort of
presentation.
Your mile markers as you
those
go.
Are my mile markers to keep me on.
Given tight instruction, if you use Twitter as an illustration, he understands it.
No, yes, we regularly do that.
I was speaking his language. I was right. I was getting credibility with my audience.
You were respecting your audience. That's right.
That's right.
All right. So our fifth question, this is breaking it down to the very, very practical. If a person wants to improve at presenting, what are some practical steps they can take to do so? So just somebody sitting here going, I have to do this. I'm stepping into a role that does this, or I preach every week. Yes. What are ways that I can get better?
Open yourself up to feedback.
Yep.
I mean, that's the only way you're going to improve. That's the only way you're going to get better is it's.
What are some systems or some practices for that? Because feedback, I'm thinking of preachers.
Yep.
Preachers have a very hard time getting feedback unless they have one of those rare contexts where they have a very healthy staff where they've kind of made themselves vulnerable
and
to somebody
trust,
else.
And they trust right. those people, yeah.
But, Eric, but a lot down, of times they don't have that.
Break down what you do at Clearview with the pastors yep. that are preaching. What's that look like?
Yep. So I'm bivocational pastor at Clearview Baptist Church in Franklin, which is it's right where I live. It's our neighborhood, which we love. I mean, we love the people, love the area, love the community. And I really so badly don't want to be the senior pastor mm-hmm. with a supporting staff. I really want it to be a team of pastors. And so there's several other pastors that are preaching and beginning to preach more. And this takes great humility on their part, and they're so godly and humble. I'm thinking of Nathan's preached, but Jacob and Mark have preached. Nathan's preached once. Jacob and Mark have preached more. And so what we've done is, they have invited 6 to 7 folks in the church. We've shown up at the chapel. This has been every time Jacob's preached, several times that Mark's preached. We've shown up in the chapel on like a Thursday night or a Tuesday night at 7:30. So it's after I've put my kids to bed. So it's not like another night away from my kids. And they preach. They preach to a room with 7 people in it. And so I've given a handout to the men ahead of time who are speaking in the audience, who's watching, and said, hey, we're going to evaluate on this.
So they're doing this before the Sunday they preach?
Yep.
Okay.
They
better be ready before Saturday night.
Yes. So they preach to a room with 7-8 people in it before the Sunday that they preach. Mm-hmm. It could be even a week and a half before. And they we evaluate. And we kind of joke around that it's like redemptive ridicule,
I like to call all of my ridicule that as well.
We call it redemptive roasting, but truly it's not, because the people who are invited love Jacob and Mark, mm-hmm. and Jacob and Mark know that they love them, and so that there's that mutual love and respect, they really are going to receive the feedback. And what's been neat to see is how it's made such a radical impact on those guys' communication ability. Yeah. I mean, Jacob and Mark are already great communicators. They're becoming better and better. I think feedback exponentially improves someone.
Well, the other thing that is, and this is another practical tip, is practice.
Yeah,
because it's repetition.
Practice with according to the book, talent is not enough.
Uh-huh.
The term deliberate practice is what makes someone great at any craft. And so deliberate practice means practice, which you just said, Barnabas, with feedback. Practice with feedback. Practice with feedback. And so if you're communicating regularly and you're not asking for feedback, and I do not mean listen to every critic. I'm not saying that. That there's a group of people who you really trust, who you know they are qualified to speak into this,
yeah,
and they love you.
Yeah, they want God's best for you.
Those two things. They don't just love you, but they're qualified, and they're not just qualified, but they also love you. They're qualified and they love you. If you invite them in to give you feedback as you speak, as you present, or whatever discipline you're involved in, you will become better.
Yeah,
and then ultimately, people are better served because. Hey, listen, presentations, they move people.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so if you can present really, really well, you're going to be serving those people better and better.
I would say it is the repetition piece. Like when I was in college, I would speak anywhere. Like anybody gives me an opportunity. For 3 years, I spoke every other Wednesday at a convalescent home. It was...
No, it's how I got started.
Yeah.
It's what you got to do.
It's that... It's the 10,000 hours rule, which yep. Malcolm Gladwell grabbed in the book Outliers, but he actually grabbed it initially from the man who wrote about deliberate practice,
right.
which is, and anyway, he didn't mean it like there's this magic moment, but he really meant it illustratively.
Like the data bears it out.
The data yeah. bears out that if you practice in one thing for mm-hmm. a sustained period of time, it's going to pay off.
And so much of that just has to do with comfort level, because being a good presenter, I mean, it's part of preparation. Part of preparation is being comfortable in the sense of I know what I'm stepping into, so that you can, if something goes awry, you can adjust on the fly. If you're uncomfortable, you freeze, you panic, you're tied to your script. So practice is a big piece of that. I mean, we've done 130-ish of these podcasts, and then I've done other podcasts, and I feel more prepared for hosting a podcast oh, yeah. now dramatically than I ever have yeah. before, because I don't know how many hours it's been. I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds at this point, and that makes me, I think, better. But the one of the other pieces I think is self-evaluation. So I hate listening to myself
talk. Oh, man, I can't stand it.
And I hate watching myself on video more than I hate listening to myself. But part of the reason that we hate it is because we see all the things that we're like, oh, I should not do that thing yep. anymore. I shouldn't say that anymore. I have a pet phrase. I have a whatever.
Yep.
And so that's a key thing as well. And if you don't have somebody else to give you feedback,
you can
give yourself feedback and go, okay, I cannot do that thing yeah. with my hands anymore. Yeah. So, I mean, I think one other tip is finding the preparation style that works for you. So, yep. there, Todd, you mentioned scripting everything out, and then yep. finding a different preparation style that was better for you. Those key points with some subpoints in between. So, there are bullet pointers, there are outliners, there are manuscripters,
and manuscripters are coming back.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I mean that in a good way. There's I think it's very healthy that some presenters and pastors have said, hey, I am best when I do manuscript, mm-hmm. and that not being considered, oh gosh, it's horrible that you do manuscript. No.
A manuscript doesn't mean read your manuscript.
No.
No.
It means that they feel that has allowed them to really right. get the most effective relay of the content yeah. that they've really spent time studying and preparing
and
to the people.
I think some of it has to do with whether or not, I mean, you will hear staunch arguments that why you should present with no notes, and others who use notes. And I think that's six one way, half dozen
yep,
the other. I
same.
Think that is
depends
a
on the person.
Yeah. I think there are people who use notes and it's very awkward because they keep glancing back and they forget their spot. And that's a sign of lacking preparation. That has nothing to do with the notes. So do you use them? Do you not? What do you take on stage with you? All of those things. But again, that comes through practice. That comes through feedback. That comes through watching yourself and going, man, I kept looking back at my notes every 60 seconds, and that's distracting to people, or whatever it is. So I think anything else come to mind in terms of practical steps for people to take? What about observing other how do you make it a point to watch other presenters and learn from them? Or is that just a thing you kind of glean by accident?
I think that can be helpful. I do caution an over-reliance on that because you can all of a sudden start to parrot somebody else's
be an
style.
Imitator.
I've seen a lot of Matt Chandler's. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen
pentameter, everything.
Like, yeah. What do you mean? Seen a lot. They have the exact rhythm. Same rhythm.
The rhythm of their speech, the cadence of their speech, the way they emphasize all that.
The way they greet the church. How's everybody doing?
That's funny.
It's exact. I mean, my dad being who he is, I've seen.
Who's your dad?
What's that?
Who's your dad?
Who's your daddy? So my dad is John Piper, for listeners who might not know.
Oh, man, I didn't even know.
And there are plenty of people who, when they preach, I hear it. I'm like, you were at the Passion One Day conference in 99, weren't
That's
you?
Funny.
You know, or whatever.
And I would say that now that I'm sitting in front of you and you just brought that up, I'm like, oh goodness, have you seen me jack one of your father's statements
or
statements are one thing. It's the imitation of style that gets me, because I look at that and I go, that doesn't scream authenticity or
screams,
you know,
imitation.
Yeah,
I would say that, and that's why I think guys have to be cautious, because I bet it happens unintentionally.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because they listen to Chandler or Piper or whoever so frequently that. And not only is it the frequency, it's the impact of the sermons that becomes so transformational in that person that then they're going to articulate it in a very similar way. So I think you just have to know that going in.
And I think you should intentionally listen or watch a variety of, I mean, if for example, I mean, TED Talks are another example. Because they're all exactly the same. There's a video out there. It's sort of mocking TED Talks called How to Be a Thought Leader. And a guy essentially gives a 5-minute TED Talk where he scripts out every movement and he's talking through it. He's like, I'm going to move to the left.
I got
to
see
put my hand here. And it basically ruins TED Talks for you because you're like, oh, it's all scripted.
Which that's when you realize something's become a cultural thing.
Right.
It's only a cultural thing when somebody starts bashing it.
And or making fun of it.
That's why you have to find a variety, because if you can listen to Andy Stanley and Tim Keller and John Piper and Rick Warren and whoever, you're going to hear a variety of styles and glean some insights from each instead of becoming a parrot.
That's good.
Good deal.
All right. Well, listeners, thanks so much for tuning in again. I hope this was helpful to you. To find the show notes on this, so best quotes, any recommended resources, as well as our blog and other leadership resources, go to lifeway.com/leadership. Check it out there. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in next time.
Don't forget to check out Southeastern Seminary's numerous education and training opportunities to help you grow in ministry. Visit sebts.edu/5LQ to learn more. That's sebts.edu/5LQ.